Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
All right, welcome everyone back to another edition of New Books in Education. This is your host, Ryan Allen, and today I'm excited to bring us a guest that we had on before with a book and a co-author, but this time we get her all to ourselves, and I have Rebecca Nato, Senior Research Associate with the Community College Research Center at Teachers College, Columbia University, and today we're going to be talking about her book, Higher Education Rulemaking, The Politics of Creating Regulatory Policy. And this is from John Hopkins University Press, and it was just published in September. So, Rebecca, welcome back to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me back.
And if we could, just to remind our listeners and everyone out there, give us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into education as a subject? What's kind of your academic background?
Okay, so as you mentioned, I'm currently Senior Research Associate at the Community College Research Center. I actually began my career as an attorney. Practiced law for approximately 5 years and decided it was time for a career change and was interested in getting into higher education administration. So that brought me to the Teachers College higher and post-secondary education program. I went in thinking I would get a master's degree, be done in a year or two, and then be working in administration somewhere. But what happened is I developed a strong interest in higher education policy. And that led me into their doctoral program. So long story short, I wound up all these years later looking into higher education rulemaking as a policy process because it was something that was interesting to me, but I noticed it was not being written about or studied as much as it could have been. And so working in higher education policy and focusing my research there, I ended up working on performance funding research with Kevin Doherty, and that's how I started at Community College Research Center.
Yeah, absolutely. And then that was we'll post a link to that interview that we had as well on performance funding. So if we could get maybe a little bit into this book, you talk about, I think, in the book that this is something that everyone sort of maybe thinks about or talks about politically, but then just the idea of how it works actually kind of flies under the radar. And I think like you kind of seek to answer a couple questions, like what happens after legislation affecting higher education is signed into law? How are these specific provisions implemented? And who actually determines the details of these programs and particular laws that have been authorized? So can we kind of get into the book a little bit and the just sort of the questions maybe that you sought to answer with this book, and kind of set the stage of the subject.
Sure. So for this book, as I mentioned, higher education rulemaking as a process was not receiving a lot of attention in the scholarly literature on higher education policy. Mm-hmm. And what it is it's basically a process for creating regulations. It occurs in the Department of Education, and rulemaking to create regulations actually occurs across different government agencies. There's a law called the Administrative Procedure Act, which governs how rulemaking takes place, and other agencies besides the Department of Education do engage in rulemaking as well. But what I think is somewhat unique to higher education rulemaking is that there's a provision in the Higher Education Act that's been there for some years that says that a process known as negotiated rulemaking must take place when permitted by law, when regulations to implement Title IV federal financial aid programs are being created. Mm. Obviously, the Title IV federal financial aid programs are very important to a lot of students who would not be able to attend college without federal financial aid. It's important to a lot of institutions that receive financial aid through their students, and particularly for-profit institutions. Federal financial aid makes up a large portion of their revenues. So this becomes a very important process. And what negotiated rulemaking is it's a process that brings together the stakeholders who are likely to be affected by the final rule into the rule drafting process. They sit down with the Department of Education over a period of days, and usually those days are spread out over over multiple months. So they might meet, for example, 3 days in March, 3 days in April, 3 days in May. They come together, they sit around the table, and they basically hammer out the language for the proposed rule. Now, if the negotiating committee comes to consensus, and that is defined as all of the parties agree on the proposed language, then that is the language that goes into the proposed rule. But if there's even one party that is dissenting, that's not agreeing to consensus on the language, then the Department of Education staff gets to write the rule basically by themselves. Now, that's not to say that the negotiations won't have an impact on that. In fact, my research shows that that the negotiations do have an impact, even when the department's not required to use that language. You could see the influence of the parties that are sitting at the table there in what the department comes up with. But it's also a process that gives the department an awful lot of power, because the department has a negotiator sitting around the table as well. So even if it's the department's negotiator that doesn't agree to the language, if you have a scenario where everyone else sitting around the table agrees, but the Department of Education's negotiator does not, then that gives the department the power to write the proposed rule on its own. And because other agencies do negotiated rulemaking as well, but because the Higher Education Act requires it of the Title IV regulations, and because Title IV is so important in higher education policy, I thought this would be an interesting process to study, because it happens so frequently and it's so closely watched by interest groups in the higher education policy arena.
Sure, sure. So if we could then, if I could turn our attention to the focus of the data, I guess, the data sources that you used. You talked to over 50 or 55 different policymakers and higher education actors, and then you also looked at 32 instances of rulemaking. So can you kind of talk about the makeup of that and sort of what your data look like?
Sure. So you're correct. I did speak to 55 individuals, some of whom are policy actors, policymakers, people who work in the Department of Education, people who work for Congress, congressional staff, but also higher education actors, people who work at institutions, people who work at associations that represent higher education institutions. And the associations are often referred to as one DuPont circle, because a lot of them are located at one DuPont circle in Washington, D.C. And also some observers of rulemaking, such as journalists and even a financial analyst who when the gainful employment rules were being developed, which affected mostly for-profit institutions, the financial analyst took a keen interest in what was going on. So so that was the makeup of my interview sample. And as you mentioned, I also purposefully selected 32 individual rules to examine. And I chose them based basically on the diversity of their subject matter, so I could get a wide range of different subject matters. The time frame in which they were created, I looked back on higher education going back to the 90s, higher education rulemaking going back to the early 90s, and I wanted to get a sample that had rules from all different time periods throughout that time frame, so I could see how things changed over time. And also, I was looking for a variety of both high prominence rules and lower prominence rules to see what sort of differences there were, whether a rule is controversial and high profile and getting a lot of media attention. How does that affect sort of what happens in the rulemaking process, as opposed to when a rule is really just kind of minor and more technical? So I wanted to get I was aiming for diversity along those three characteristics in my rule sample, my focal rule sample.
Sure, sure. And I think you specifically talk about two gainful employment rules and then accreditation and student outcomes.
That's right. I focused in the book, I focused on those two rules because I felt like they were exemplary of a lot of the themes I saw coming out of my research. The gainful employment rules, the first one was began to be developed, I think, in 2009, 2010, and when it was finally issued, it was already 2011. The second one was issued in 2014. And basically what they do is they try to define a term that appears in the Higher Education Act, the term being gainful employment, basically requiring that career-focused higher education programs, such as those that you'll see at a lot of for-profit institutions, that they can receive Title IV federal financial aid funds if, among other things, they provide training in a recognized field that that allows students to become gainfully employed. Mm-hmm. So when the Obama administration first came in, there was an attempt to enact this gainful employment rule that would basically define what that meant. And there was a whole lot of requirements that were going to be imposed on institutions that that provide career education programs and that are subject to that gainful employment requirement. These are basically accountability measures, certain disclosures that they would have to make, certain debt to income ratio that their alumni would have to meet. And the reason behind that is because that was just following a big recession in the economy, and there were a large number of students who had attended for-profit institutions that weren't paying back their federal student loans. So this was an attempt to sort of impose some accountability for that.
Sure.
Excuse me.
Yeah,
The accreditation and student outcomes rule occurred during the Bush administration, and that one actually did not go into the final rule stage. That one was coming out of the Spellings Commission, which basically was a commission that former Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings had created to study higher education and to make recommendations for higher education policies to improve higher education in the United States. And one of the things they wanted to do was to tie student outcomes to accreditation, so that there would be some sort of an examination of how students are doing, some sort of value-added analysis of how much students are learning, and tie that somehow to accreditation. If you recall, there was the No Child Left Behind Act, which was mm-hmm. an accountability act in the K-12 sector.
Right.
And excuse me.
Okay.
And so this was sort of a counterpart. This was going to be a counterpart to that for higher education. What ended up happening was there was a huge backlash after that rulemaking began, and it was the backlash was bipartisan. You saw Republicans as well as Democrats right. speaking out about how this would be, if they were to create this rule, would be overstepping the department's authority. The institutions certainly were not excited about the prospect of this happening, and the rulemaking never went forward. So I think if you examine those different rules together, the two gainful employment rules and sort of the trajectory that those took, as well as this accreditation and student outcomes rule, they really tell the story of what happens in the higher education rulemaking process pretty nicely.
Mm, very nice. Very nice. We keep moving further, I think, kind of diving further into that with the idea. You sort of do a good job, I think, of melding theory with what's actually sort of happening.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can maybe kind of talk about how in the federal bureaucracy, yeah, that's kind of hard to say, federal bureaucracy, if you could, how that sort of matches up with theory. I think you look into the policy process with Kingdon and then advocacy coalition theory. So can you kind of talk about how that's working?
Yeah. So this research, and I don't think I've mentioned this yet, but this research is basically based on my dissertation, my doctoral dissertation. And when I was writing my proposal, I was coming up with this conceptual framework. And so I borrowed some policy theories, Kingdon's basically his multiple streams, mm-hmm. Revised garbage can model of the agenda setting process.
Right.
And also the advocacy coalition framework, which is a very comprehensive process that looks at different aspects of policymaking, including the policy actors and what coalitions they form, and then how different surrounding contexts influence policymaking and what policies are created. And also importantly, how the role that beliefs play, that policy actors' beliefs about things, for example, the subject matters of policies, what role they play in sort of coalition formation and the strategies that they use to influence policymaking, and then how those beliefs are often reflected in final policies. So based on those theories, I created this conceptual framework that wanted to look at the entirety of the higher education rulemaking process, because as I said, it's not something that had been studied that comprehensively before. So using those theories, my research questions focus on who are the actors, the policy actors, the higher education actors, who are involved in the process, who are they, how much meaningful influence do they have, over rulemaking outcomes? Mm-hmm. Secondly, what strategies did they put in place in order to influence rulemaking? And then third, what do those surrounding contexts, what kind of influence do they have? For example, political context, economic context, other contexts such as whether a high-profile event occurs. Kingdon talks about policy windows being these sort of high-profile occurrences that allow certain policies to sort of come through at certain opportune times. Mm-hmm. Sort of the melding of the different streams of policy problems and policy solutions and policy context. And then finally, what role do the beliefs play? What right. role do policy actors' beliefs play? In this process, it's interesting. There are beliefs about the substantive policy areas being regulated, of course, but there's also beliefs about regulation itself. How much should the Department of Education be regulating? Is regulation a good thing? So I found that beliefs about both of those aspects, beliefs about regulation and also beliefs about the underlying subject matters of rules, were influencing the process and were being reflected in the final mm-hmm. rules.
Right. I think one of the things that I thought was interesting is you said that, or maybe someone reported to you that people who were against sort of these regulations were often the most involved in regulations because they were there sort of to make sure that they're protecting their own self-interest.
That's right. I think it might be tempting to think that people who have anti-regulation beliefs might stay away from the process just for ideological reasons. But in fact, a lot of the times, the people who wanted to restrict regulations were more involved because they wanted to be that check on the Department of Education to make sure that they weren't over, that the department was not overstepping its authority.
Mm-hmm. And usually within the advocacy coalition theory and the framework, we're seeing these coalitions sort of build up and go away after, like, you know, maybe like a 10-year period.
Right.
Did you identify any shocks that really changed up these coalitions, or did they change, or why or why not?
Well, in this instance, the coalitions definitely formed, but they were often formed based on shared interests as opposed to shared beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, a lot of the shared beliefs and shared interests would coincide with each other, but sometimes it was communicated to me that there were people from very different ideological perspectives, different sides of the aisle, who joined together to form coalitions because they wanted a common goal, even if the beliefs sort of underlying the reasons for why they wanted that common goal were different.
Mm-hmm.
I think the accreditation rulemaking that I just spoke about is one example of that, because you did have people from both major political parties sort of joining together to stop that regulation. On the Republican side, it was more of that anti-regulation ideology. The Department of Education should not be regulating in this area, but there was also the beliefs on the parts of the institutions, for example, that, well, they're not opposed to regulation per se, but in this case, they were opposed to it because it would intrude upon institutional autonomy. So I saw a lot of coalitions that would form for maybe just for one rulemaking.
Mm-hmm.
So it certainly wouldn't last 10 years. It might last just until the next time they did mm-hmm. a rulemaking, which could be several months or maybe a year later.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would be on different coalitions again.
Fantastic. And I know another important aspect of this is sort of which party is in control of the
yes.
government at the time. So how much of a factor did you find, or could you kind of talk about how much of a factor that was?
Yeah, well. Interestingly, I did find some interesting things to come out of that particular context. First and foremost, I think whoever the president is, and that president's political party is going to have an influence on basically the content of regulations and what they're going to look like. There was one particular subject of regulation that I traced basically from the early 90s through the early years of the Obama administration, and that was an incentive compensation regulation. There was some language in the Higher Education Act in 1992 that basically forbade incentive compensations or bonuses to be paid to admissions and financial aid personnel based on basically the number of students that they enroll.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the Congress saw that as a conflict of interest and forbade that. And then in 1994, during the Clinton administration, the Department of Education issued a rule basically mirroring that language from the statute and putting it into regulation form. Fast forward to 2002 during the George W. Bush administration, and what the Department of Education did was it elucidated a number of so-called safe harbors that would basically allow certain types of incentive compensation to be paid under certain circumstances without violating that incentive compensation rule from the Higher Education Act. I think there were 12 safe harbors. Some of them included certain types of internet recruitment, token gifts to students or alumni under certain circumstances, incentive payments based on student completion, and a few other areas. Then move into the early years of the Obama administration, and there was a rollback of those safe harbors. And that, of course, resulted in some controversy because a lot of the institutions that were using those types of incentive payments under the safe harbors were for-profit institutions. So an association representing the for-profits actually sued the Department of Education and the Obama administration to get those rules rolled back. And it was in litigation for a while, and it wasn't a complete victory for either side. I think the judge had said something about having to provide a solid reasoning for why these prohibitions were in the regulations. And then recently, the Department of Education announced that although the regulations are still on the books, they're not going to be enforcing them, certain ones, as vigorously as they would have otherwise. So that's how that one played out. But you can see how that regulation evolved from first in a Democratic administration and then into a Republican administration, and then once again into a Democratic administration, how it went back and forth of being more restrictive of incentive compensations during the Democratic administrations and more allowing of certain types of incentive compensations during the Republican administration.
Yeah, that's one thing that I noticed that you talked about. I think it was actually towards the beginning, but just to bring it back, is the idea that they have these sort of programs that are just not funded at all, and how that kind of, it maybe seems like it's there, but it because there's no money, it's not actually operating.
Right. Yes, well, under the Higher Education Act, which is an authorizing statute, and it has a number of different provisions and titles and many, many programs that it authorizes, but these programs are funded through a separate appropriations process. So sometimes there will be a program that is technically on the books, you can look it up, but it isn't currently receiving funds, and therefore it won't currently be active.
Right, right. Okay, well, keep on moving along through the book, and you do a section on the use of technology, and I think even somebody you cite is talking about dubbing it electronic rulemaking or e-rulemaking. So how much of a factor did that have in this process, and are we seeing coalitions maybe or different actors able to join together through this, or can you just kind of talk about that through the process?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Over the past, I'd say, 10 years or so, maybe even more than that, there's been a move to make some parts of the rulemaking process electronic. Regulations.gov launched a while back. I believe the Department of Education started using it for Office of Post-Secondary Education rules around 2007 was the date that I was told. So little less than 10 years ago. But basically what regulations.gov does is it allows interested parties to comment on proposed regulations online. Now, there's a phase of the rulemaking process. After a proposed rule goes into the Federal Register, there will be a certain period of time during which anybody, members of the public, interest groups who have not participated in a successful negotiated rulemaking, that's one exception, but basically anybody else, including members of Congress, can submit a comment on the rule, commenting on it, how it should be changed, parts that they like, parts that they don't like, to the Department of Education. Now, in the past, before that whole process was made electronic, the old-fashioned way of doing this was you would just, you know, write up a letter and put it in the mail to the department. And even going back before that, before the Federal Register was available online, you had to go to the library, find the Federal Register, and look at the rule there. So as you can see, that takes some effort. It means that somebody has to be able to have the time to do that,
right.
but also have the knowledge to know that these regulations are out there, to know where to find the Federal Register, to know how to locate a particular proposed rule in it, which can be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It really sort of left this commenting notice and comment process up to people who had resources or at least had a lot of knowledge about how the process worked. What regulations.gov does is it puts all of this online. You can see the proposed rule online. You can make a comment on it online. Makes it very easy. You can do this from your home. You could do it, anytime during the day or night. And so it really opens up access to the process. Now, what's interesting that I found is, based on talking to policy actors and higher education actors who are involved in this process, is there might be more comments coming in because it's now easier to make comments. But first of all, you still have to have enough knowledge to even know that this is going on. It's not like some notice is necessarily going to show up in your inbox, an email telling you that this is happening unless you've signed up for a listserv, which also indicates that you have some interest in this. But the fact that they might be getting more comments almost makes this less of an effective process.
Right.
For influencing rulemaking, because, you know, back when the department was receiving 50 or 60 comments, they could read all of them carefully. Now it's not uncommon for them to get tens of thousands of comments. Each of the gainful employment rules alone, each of them received more than 90,000 comments. So that greatly reduces the amount of time that the Department of Education staff can spend looking at comments. So the way it was described to me was, yes, it maybe has opened up access to certain people to make comments, but it has decreased the effectiveness of them. It's diluted the effectiveness of them.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Just if you're getting flooded with all these things online, are you actually going to sift through literally everything? Or are you going to skim a couple of them and consider it done? You kind of briefly talk a little about social media, just the idea of sort of putting out a call for action or something. One of the quote. How much of a factor does that have, or are we still in an infancy stage of trying to understand where that comes into play?
Yeah. So this was still in its infancy stage when I was doing the research. I do think that more could be done with social media. There's a project going on at Cornell University called Regulation Room, where they're making an effort to use social media with certain agencies. Not the Department of Education, but other federal agencies, to try and bring more public involvement into rulemaking. I know that there are some lawmakers who would like to see greater effectiveness of public comments. So this could be one way to do that, one way to engage more of the public in social media. Having said that, I have seen notices come from the Department of Education's Twitter feed, for example. There's a lot of information up on the department's own website. So you can find a lot of information there about when negotiated rulemaking is taking place, and they post the handouts, the documents that they hand out from negotiated rulemaking on their website. They post verbatim transcripts from regional meetings that occur before negotiated rulemaking to get ideas for topics they might want to negotiate. So they are putting the information out there. I do think it could be used a little bit more creatively to bring in sort of a wider audience for the rules and the rulemaking process.
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, having a BuzzFeed listicle of the top regulations for higher ed in 2016.
Right. making it a little bit interesting.
Right.
On the other hand, and I don't know that this is behind anyone's thinking, but. It may be in the interest of the Department of Education not to have a ton of people involved in it, because then, you know, as we were talking about with the commenting, it makes more material for them to go through. So that would take longer to get the regulations out, make the rulemaking process more complicated, and might also, in a sense, dilute the effectiveness of it, because you'd have so many more voices coming into the process.
Right.
Now, I don't know that that's what's behind their thinking, but it is something, it is a factor to think about.
I see. Okay. Well, we're kind of coming up on the end of the interview, but I just want to ask a couple more questions if we can. You kind of talk about the implications of this study. Can you kind of get into that? Especially on the sort of the practice side, I think. Our listeners
are
interested.
So my research can sort of shed light on this practice, which I think is, is important in and of itself. As I keep saying, it's not something that's been studied a lot. It's not something that a lot of people, particularly in the general public, know about, even though these regulations are very important for higher education and even for student aid, which affects so many people. So just knowing more about the process and how it works, I think, is valuable information for members of the public, also for institutions and associations that represent them, other interest groups that have been involved in the process, and policymakers themselves, whether they're in Congress or in the department, can look at my research and get an understanding as to what is happening and what parties are exerting meaningful influence in the process. I think it's also useful for sort of predicting the future. Where do we go next as far as rulemaking? And I can speak a little bit about that if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think everyone is very curious about what's going to happen in the next 4 to 8 years. So yeah, if you can give us some insight, that'd be great.
Right. So we have a new administration coming in January. We're switching from a Democratic to a Republican administration, which, as I mentioned, that can certainly change the content of rules. I think in this case, as we saw with the Obama administration sort of doing stricter regulations on the for-profit sector, I think we might see a bit of that, if not a lot of it, rolled back in the new administration, which does have ties to the business community, where you might expect less regulation of the for-profit sector and more sort of incentives to expand for-profit education. I also think that typically one of the other patterns I noticed in my research was that when you have a Democrat in the White House and then Democrats controlling Congress, I noticed that on average there were more higher education rules being issued under that type of control of government than under any other form of control of government, whether it's Republican control or sort of divided control.
Right.
And then when you have a Republican in the White House and Republican-controlled Congress, that was when you saw the least, on average, number of higher education rulemakings coming out, at least over the past 25 years.
Right.
Now, even though we're moving into a period of united control under Republicans, I don't think that we're going to see that pattern this time. One of the reasons for that is, as I just mentioned, there might be a move to roll back some of the regulations on the for-profit sector that came in during the Obama administration. But also, the Higher Education Act is due to be reauthorized, and it's actually overdue to be reauthorized. And I think now that we have united government under one party, it'll be much easier to get that legislation through and get it signed by the president. So once a new reauthorization of such a large bill as the Higher Education Act comes through, you generally see a spike in new rules that come out to implement the programs under that new authorizing statute. So for those reasons, I do think we are going to see some higher education rulemaking activity during the next few years, and it will be very interesting to watch.
Fantastic. Well, that's great. I think all of our listeners and everybody really is very curious of what's in store for us, and so that's great. It's a nice prediction. So I guess, we're kind of to the end of the interview. It's really been nice talking to you. But, with the book, there's always something next. So what are you working on now? What's your next project?
Well, I'm in the process of working on I'm part of a team that is examining developmental education. So basically students who enter college and their skills are not up to college level in some area, whether it's in English or in mathematics. A lot of times they will go into developmental education to get the skills that they need to move into college level coursework. I'm part of a large team at the Community College Research Center that's investigating what those programs look like. My aspect of it is descriptive, and so we're looking at things like what do the assessment practices look like, what do the instructional practices look like in developmental education, and a number of other similar descriptive research questions surrounding that.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely look forward to that research coming out. That's actually very important. So fantastic stuff.
Thank you.
And I just want to tell all my listeners, please go check out Higher Education Rulemaking, The Politics of Creating Regulatory Policy. And I want to thank Rebecca Nato and her great work and this great interview. And to everyone out there, I hope you learned.